The rookie was making check marks on a list attached to a clipboard.
Criteria, the other cop continued, include references to the Book of Revelation, males with shoulder length or longer hair, endangerment through automotive absent-mindedness, all of which you folks have been exhibiting.
Yeah, man, Dinas put in, but we're in a Mercedes and it's only painted one color, beige. Don't we get points for that?
Doc noticed for the first time that both cops were, well, not trembling, the police wouldn't tremble, but vibrating, for sure, with the post-mansonical nerves that currently rule the area.
We'll hand this all in, Mr. Sportillo. It'll go in some master data bank here and in Sacramento. And unless there's wants or warrants we don't know about, you won't hear any more on this.
Following Dr. Blatnoid's directions, Doc turned off Sunset, breaking almost immediately for a guard gate staffed by private heat of some kind.
"Evening, Heinrich," boomed Rudy Blatnoid.
"Nice to see you, Dr. B,"
replied the sentry, waving him through. They went winding through Bel Air, up hillsides and canyons, arriving at a mansion with another gate, low and nearly invisible inside its landscape gardening, seeming so much constructed of night itself that at sunrise it might all disappear. Behind the gate glimmered a pale slash through the dark, which Doc finally figured out was a moat with a drawbridge over it.
"Won't be a minute,"
Dr. Blatnoid climbing out, grabbing the bag from under the front seat, and getting into a cryptic discussion over the gate intercom with a voice Doc guessed to be female, before the gate opened and the drawbridge came down, rumbling and creaking. Then the night was very quiet again. Not even the distant freeway traffic could be heard, or the footpads of coyotes, or the slither of snakes.
"Way too quiet," said Dinas. "It's freaking me out, man."
"I think we'll wait here, on this side of the moat," Doc said. "Okay?"
Dinas rolled an enormous joint and lit up, and soon the interior of the Mercedes was full of smoke. After a while there was shrieking on the gate intercom.
"Hey, man," said Dinas. "You don't have to yell, man."
"Dr. Blatnoid wishes us to inform you," announced the woman at the other end, "that he will be remaining as our guest, and there is thus no further need for you to wait."
"Yeah, and you talk like a robot, man."
It took them a while to find their way back to Sunset.
"I guess I'll crash with some friends in Pacific Palisades," Japonica announced.
"Mind letting us off at the Greyhound in Santa Monica? We can grab the midnight local."
"By the way, aren't you the man who found me and brought me back to my dad that time?"
"Just doing my job,"
Doc immediately defensive.
"Did he really want me back?"
"I've worked gigs like that a couple of times since," Doc said carefully, in case she had to drive much more tonight. "And he seemed like your standard worried parent."
"He's an asshole," Japonica assured him.
"Here, this is my office number. I don't have regular hours, so you may not always find me in."
She shrugged and managed a smile.
"If it's meant to be."
Things were weird for a few days with the Dart over in Beverly Hills, though Doc imagined it was having itself a nice time in the company of all those Jaguars and Porsches and so forth. When he finally went over to pick up his ride at Resurrection of the Body, a collision emporium somewhat south of Olympic, he ran into his friend Tito Stavrou, having a lively argument with Manuel, the owner. Tito ran a limo service, though there was only one unit in his fleet. Unfortunately, not one of those limos able to glide from the curb, much less insert itself effortlessly into traffic. No, this one lurched from the curb, percussively into traffic.
being in fact garaged for at least half of any given premium period, as Tito's latest insurance carrier had just discovered, much to its own, and you can imagine how much to Tito's, dismay. Or being attended to by various sand and fill crews around the greater L.A. area. One calendar year, it got repainted 6 times.
"You sure you mean limo and not lemon?" suggested Manuel,
as part of the recreational abuse he liked to lay on Tito whenever the vehicle showed up with a new set of dings. They stood out in the main shed, assembled from a Quonset hut, first cut in half lengthwise, and the two pieces then rearranged so that they met in a point high overhead to make a sort of church-like vault.
"It would be cheaper if you just pay me in front, small fee. Any time you want it painted, just bring it by, day or night. Any color in stock, including the metallics. In and out in a couple hours."
"What worries me," said Tito, "is that in and out, you know, all these high-risk elements of the auto parts community you deal with."
"This is resurrection essay. We're in the miracle business. If Jesus turned water into wine in front of your face, would you be going, 'What's this I'm drinking? I want a Dom Perignon or some shit.' If I was that picky about what comes in here for a paint job, ask for what? Their license and registration? Then they're really pissed off. They go someplace else. Plus, I get put on a shit list I might not want to be on."
Manuel noticed Doc for the first time.
"You the Bentley?"
"The 64 Dodge Dart."
Manuel looked back and forth between Doc and Tito for a while.
"You guys know each other?"
"That would really depend,"
Doc was about to say, but Manuel went on.
"I was going to charge you more, but guys like Tito here, they're subsidizing guys like you."
The amount of the invoice was, nevertheless, a Beverly Hills type of number, and half Doc's day got blown setting up a payment schedule.
"Come on," said Tito. "I'll buy you lunch. I need your advice on something."
They went down to Pico and headed toward Rancho Park. This street was a chowhound's delight. Back when Doc was still new in town, one day around sunset, the daily event, not the boulevard, he was in Santa Monica near the western end of Pico. The light over all deep L.A. softening to purple with some darker gold to it. And from this angle and hour of the day, it seemed to him he could see all the way down Pico for miles into the heart of the great megalopolis itself, having yet to discover that if he wanted to, he could also eat his way down Pico night after night for a long while before repeating an ethnic category. This did not always turn out to be good news for the indecisive doper, who might know he was hungry but not necessarily how to deal with it in terms of specific food. Many was the night Doc ran out of gas and his munchies afflicted companions out of patience long before settling on where to go eat. Today, they ended up at a Greek restaurant called Teke, which according to Tito meant an old-time hashish parlor in Greek.
"I hope this won't be a problem," said Tito. "But word is around, you've been working on this Mickey Wolfman case."
"Not how I'd put it. Nobody's paying me. Sometimes I think all it is guilt. Wolfman's girlfriend is my ex-old lady. She said she needed help, so I've been trying to help."
Tito, who had made a point of facing the front entrance, lowered his voice till Doc could hardly hear him.
"I'm taking a chance that you ain't bent, Doc. You ain't bent, are you?"
"Not so far, but I could always use a nice envelope full of cash."
"These guys," an unhappy look crossing Tito's face, "don't hand you envelopes. It's more like, do what they want, maybe they don't fuck you up too bad."
"You're saying this is mob-related?"
"I only wish. I mean,
I know some family badasses who scare most people. They sure scare me. But I wouldn't ever go to them with this. They'd just take a look at who it is and go like, Pasadena, man. Not to mention you owe the money. No more. I kicked all that. What? No horses, no panpollers, no little T-Rex, no Salvatore Papercut Gazzoni, no Adrian Prussia? Nope. Even Adrian's off my ass anymore. All paid off. The VIG, everything. Good news, 'cause sooner or later that fucker would be reaching for his baseball bat, going to town on your head or something. Man gives Loan Sharkin a bad name. They're all in my sorry past now. I've been 12-stepping it, Doc. Meetings, everything. Well, Inez must be happy. How long's it been? Coming up on 6 months next weekend. We're gonna go celebrate it in style, too. We're taking the limo to Vegas, staying at Caesar's. Excuse me, Tito. Am I confusing Las Vegas with someplace else, where all they do is fucking gamble nonstop? How do you expect to avoid temptation? Hey, that's just it. How am I ever gonna know? Thing is to jump in, see what happens. Oh, boy. This is all cool with Inez? Her idea. Mike, the owner and cook, appeared with a huge plate of dolmades, Kalamata olives, and midget spanakopitas. It looked like it would take a week to polish off. You're sure you want to eat here? He greeted Tito. This is Doc. He saved my life once. And this is how you thank him? Mike shaking his head in reproof. Think long and hard, my friends, muttering back to the kitchen. I saved your life? Tito shrugged. That time up on Mulholland. You saved mine, man. You're the one knew where it was. This particular it being a carnapped 1934 Hispano Suiza J-12, whose return Doc had been negotiating with a Lithuanian thyroid case who showed up carrying a modified AK-47 with a banana clip so oversized that he kept tripping over it, which, looking back, was what had saved everybody's lives, probably. I was doing that all for myself, man. You happened to be there when we brought it back, and all that money started flying around. Whatever, Doc. There's something now that you're the only one I can tell it to. A quick look around. Doc, I was one of the last people to talk to Mickey Wolfman before he dropped off the screen. Shit, replied Doc encouragingly. And no, I haven't been near the heat with this. It would get back to these guys before I was out the door, and I'd end up a shark hors d'oeuvre. D&D, Tito. What happened? Mickey got to where he didn't always trust his drivers. They were most of them ex-cons, which meant they had their own IOUs to pay off that sometimes he didn't know about. So once in a while he calls me on the unlisted line, and I pick him up some place we decide on at the last minute. You use that limo? Not exactly low profile. Nah, we'd use Falcons or Novas. I can always score one on short notice. Even a V-dub, if it ain't painted too funny. So, the day Mickey disappeared, he called you. You took him someplace? He wanted me to pick him up. He called in the middle of the night. It sounded like a payphone. He was talking real quiet. He was scared, like somebody was after him. He gave me an address out of town. I drove up there and waited, but he never showed. After a couple hours, I was getting too much attention, so I split. Where was this? Ojai, near some place called Chryskylodon. I've been hearing about it, Doc said. Some nut house for the upper brackets. Old Indian word that means serenity. Ha! Tito shook his head. Who told you that? It's in their brochure. It ain't Indian. It's Greek, trust me. They talked Greek around the house all the time I was coming up.
What's it mean in Greek?
Well, it's squashed together a little, but it means like a gold tooth, this one here. He tapped at a canine.
Oh, shit. Fang? Could it be that?
Yeah, close enough. Gold Fang.
Chapter 12.
Doc made a couple of phone calls and took the back route up by way of Burbank and Santa Paula, reaching the Ojai turnoff just before lunchtime. There were plenty of signs to point the way to the Chryskylodon Institute. The high-rent Laughing Academy was located close enough to Crotona Hill to cash in on the mystiques of better-known spiritual facilities like the Inner School and the Amorc. The main house, a red-tile and white stucco mission revival mansion, was surrounded by 100 acres of orchards and pasture and sycamore woods. At the front gate, Doc was met by long-haired attendants in flowing robes, under which they were packing smiths in shoulder rigs.
Larry Sportello, I have an appointment?
If you don't mind, brother.
Sure, grope ahead. I ain't packing. Hell, I ain't even holding.
The procedure was to park in a lot by the gate and wait for an Institute shuttle bus to run you up to the main house. The gate had a sign over it, which read, "Straight is hip." Doc had got himself up today in an Edwardian jacket and bell-bottoms, and not quite matching a no longer fashionable shades of brown, narrowly trimmed late-movie mustache, hair brill-creamed into a high pompadour with long sideburns, all meant to suggest a sleazy and vaguely anxious go-between who couldn't himself begin to afford the fees this place would be asking. From the looks he was getting, the put-together seemed to be working.
"We were just about to go have lunch," the associate director, Dr. Threeply, making with the fake sympathetic wrinkled forehead. "Why don't you join us? Afterward, we can show you around the facility."
Dr. Threeply was a shifty specimen with that quality, now and then observed in aluminum siding and screen door salesmen. Of once having been through something, a marriage, a criminal proceeding, traumatic enough to have torqued him permanently out of tolerance, so that now he had to beg potential clients to ignore this unspecified character handicap. Waiting on tables at lunch in the administrative lounge were inmates who seemed to be working in lieu of paying the full fee.
"Thank you, Kimberly. Hands steady as a rock today, it seems."
"So happy you noticed, Dr. Threeply. More soup?"
Doc took a forkful of some unfamiliar vegetable loaf halfway to his mouth, reflected that if these folks out here were mental cases, then what about farther back in the kitchen, well out of the public gaze, like doing the cooking, for example?
"Try some of this Chenin Blanc, Mr. Sportello, right from our own vineyard."
Doc had learned from his dad, Leo, and later cruising supermarket shelves, that Blanc meant white, and that California whites tended to be, well, at least whiter than the queasy shade of yellow he was looking at. He squinted at the label and noticed an ingredient list several lines long, with a note in parentheses, "Continued on back of bottle." But whenever he tried, as casually as he could, to have a look at the label on the back, he noticed he was getting these stares, and sometimes people even reached and turned the label away so he couldn't read it.
"You've been here with us before?"
said one of the staff shrinks. "I know I've seen your face. First time I've been down here. Normally I never get much south of South City."
"And abnormally?"
Dr. Threeply chuckled.
"What?"
"I only meant that with any number of qualified facilities in the Bay Area, why bother coming all the way down here to us?"
The others at the table leaned forward,
as if keenly interested in Doc's answer. Time to pull out some of the stuff he'd run through with Sortilege.
"I believe," said Doc earnestly, "that just as chakras can be identified on the human body, so does the body of Earth have these special places, concentrations of spiritual energy, grace, if you will, and that Ojai, for the presence of Mr. J. Krishnamurti alone, certainly qualifies as one of the more blessed of planetary chakras, which regrettably cannot be said for San Francisco or its immediate vicinity." After a small patch of silence, somebody said,
"You mean Walnut Creek isn't a chakra?"
Which drew nodding and chuckling from colleagues.
"Some religious thing," supposed Dr. Threeply, maybe trying to restore an air of professionalism at the table, though what profession was unclear. After lunch, Doc was bustled around on a tour which included dormitories, a staff lounge with a dozen TV sets, and a full-service bar, the sensory deprivation tanks, the Olympic-sized pool, and the rock-climbing wall.
"What's in here?" Doc, trying to seem no more than casually curious.
"A brand new wing for housing our non-compliant cases unit," announced Dr. Threeply. "Not quite operational yet, but soon to be the Institute's pride and joy. You may certainly have a look inside if you wish, though there's nothing much to see."
He swung open one of the doors, and just inside the vestibule, Doc caught a glimpse of the same publicity photo he'd seen at the Wolfman home, of Sloan in a skip loader delivering an oversized check. As closely as he could, he scanned the photograph again, and noticed now that none of the other faces in it seemed to be Mickey's. Mickey was nowhere in sight, but Doc was visited by the creepy feeling that somewhere close by, in some weird indeterminate space whose residents weren't sure where they were, inside or out of the frame, might indeed be some version of Mickey. Not quite in the same way that the lady with the big check was a version of Sloane, but altered and, he shivered, maybe mentally or even physically compromised. Past this vestibule here, he could make out a long corridor lined with identical, knobless doors, receding into metallic shadow. Before the main door swung shut again, Doc just had time to notice a chunk of marble with a bronze plaque that read, "Made possible through the selfless generosity of a devoted friend of Chryskylodon." If Sloane was endowing loony bins with Mickey's money, why not take some credit? Why be anonymous?
"Nice," said Doc. "Come, we'll have a look outside."
As they moved out into the grounds, Doc could see, through the haze, eucalyptus trees, colonnaded walkways, neoclassic temples faced in white marble, fountains fed by hot springs. Everything looked like painted glass mats in old Technicolor movies. Well-to-do nutcases and their attendants drifted now and then in the distance. As Aunt Reet had suggested, there was a lot of capital improvement in progress. Landscaping crews tossed through the air and neatly caught long, curved stacks of clay flower pots. Framers played hardcore acid rock and roll out of truck radios and hammered along with the beat. Paving crews shoveled blacktop, and rollers rolled it smooth. There were tennis courts and swimming pools and outdoor volleyball. The Zen Garden, according to Dr. Threeply, had been transported from Kyoto, reassembled here exactly in place, each grain of white sand, each textured rock. A ceremonial bell stood nearby, and next to it, Doc noticed a strange, shadowy gazebo, like a steel engraving in some old and likely forbidden book, out of which he thought he heard sounds of chanting.
"Advanced Therapy Group," said Threeply.
He led Doc to a concealed spiral stairway
and they descended into a sort of grotto, damp and dimly lit. The temperature dropped 20 degrees. From down the damp corridors, the sound of chanting got louder. Three-Ply led Doc into a soundproof space behind one-way mirrors and among underground shadows green as aquarium slime. Doc immediately recognized one of a dozen kneeling figures in robes as Coy Harlingen. Now, what the fuck? As it turned out, this was not the only familiar face around here. Lounging by the observation window was an orderly who had apparently brought the inmates here and was waiting to take them back. He was passing the time with the age-old diversion of rolling up his necktie, holding it for a minute under his chin, and then lifting his chin and letting the tie unroll again. Hours of fun. Doc didn't notice the tie itself until he'd been watching this for a while. And then he either thought, holy shit, or actually hollered it out loud. He wasn't sure right away which, because what this gorilla happened to be wearing was one of Mickey Wolfman's own custom-made specials. In fact, the exact tie Doc had failed to find in Mickey's closet, the one with Shasta hand-painted on it, in a pose submissive enough to break an ex-old man's heart. That is, if he was in the mood. Doc was just able to return to the present tense in time to hear Dr. Three-Ply wrapping up some commentary and asking if there were any questions. Several, in fact. Doc wanted at least to mention to the gorilla by the window something like, "Hey, that's my ex-old lady you're fondling there." But how wise was that? The world had just been disassembled. Anybody here could be working any hustle you could think of, and it was long past time to be, as Shaggy would say, like, getting out of here, Scoob. Loaded down with application kits and institute literature, Doc climbed onto the shuttle back to the main gate. At the creepy gazebo stop, one passenger got on, who turned out to be Coy Harlingen, in a hooded robe, making dummy-up gestures, which included, "Get off when I do." They got off by the dodgeball court. Some kind of regional all-institution playoffs were in progress, with a lot of matching T-shirts and screaming, not all of it playoff-related, and nobody paid much attention to Coy and Doc.
"Here, put this on."
One of the hooded robes people wore around here, which Doc doubted came from a religious supply house, more like some clearance sale of no longer stylish beachwear. He slid into it.
"Wow, makes a man feel like Lawrence of Arabia. As long as we walk slow and stoned, nobody's gonna bother us. Here, maybe this'll help." Producing and lighting a pinner of gold Colombian.
They passed it back and forth, and after a while, Coy said,
"So, you got to see Hope?"
"For a minute. She's okay, and looks like she's been staying clean, too." It wasn't easy to see what exactly was going on with Coy behind his shades, but his voice dropped to a whisper.
"You talk to her?"
I put my head in the front door, pretended to be one of these magazine hustlers, caught a glimpse of that little amethyst, too, and from what I could see, they're both doing fine, and I almost sold Hope a subscription to Psychology Today.
"Well," Coy shaking his head slowly, as if listening to a solo, "you don't know how worried I've been." Maybe more than he meant to say. "She kicked? Are you sure? Is she on a program? Or how's she doing it?"
"She's back teaching," is all she said. "Public health, drug awareness, something like that."
"And you're not going to tell me where?"
"Not even if I knew."
"You really think that I would ever start giving either of them shit?"
"I don't do matrimonials, man. I have a terrible history of putting in, and it's never ended well."
Coy walked along with his face in the shadow of his hood. Don't matter, I guess.
How's that?
No way I can ever go back to them.
Doc knew that tone of voice and hated it. It reminded him of too many vomit-spattered toilets, freeway overpasses, edges of cliffs in Hawaii, always pleading with men younger than himself, distraught with what they were so sure was love. It was actually why he'd quit doing matrimonials, in spite of which he now found himself prompting, "You can't go back, because if you did..."
Coy shook his head. "It would be my ass, understand? My family's, too. This is like a gang. Once you're in, por vida."
"Did you know that when you joined up?"
"All I knew was we couldn't do each other no good staying together. The baby was looking like shit and worse every day. We'd get fucked up and just sit there and go, 'We're dragging each other down, what are we gonna do?' and then end up doing nothing. Or we'd say, 'Wait till we score again, and that's out of the way, then we'll come up with something.' But that never happened either. So here came this opportunity. These people up here had money. It wasn't like it was Bible freaks wandering up and down the beach screaming at you or nothing. They really wanted to help."
It was occurring to Doc now, as he recalled what Jason Velveeta had said about vertical integration, that if the Golden Fang could get its customers strung out, why not turn around and also sell them a program to help them kick, get them coming and going, twice as much revenue and no worries about new customers, as long as American life was something to be escaped from. The cartel could always be sure of a bottomless pool of new customers.
"They just gave me the tour here," Doc said. "Thinking about signing yourself in? Not me. Couldn't afford it."
By now, they were tuned to each other enough that Coy, if he wanted, could take this for an opening to talk about what kind of a deal he'd made. But he just paced along in silence. "Short of actual marriage counseling," Doc said carefully, "if I did just run a fast check and happened to find some angle you maybe haven't thought of, nothing personal." Was that a small tremor of anger? "But there's too much you haven't thought of. You want to run your check, I can't stop you. But maybe you'll wish you hadn't." They had walked almost to the gate, and the shadows around the place were lengthening. Back at the beach, the sea breeze would be turning around about now. "I can dig you trying to chase me off of this," Doc said. "And it's also a bad idea for me to try and phone you. But look, whatever it is you court inside, I'm still out here, on the outside of it. I can move in ways you may not be able to."
"I can't come any further now," Coy said.
They were in an apricot orchard near the gate.
"Here, let me have the robe back."
Doc must have taken his eye off Coy for a second. Somehow, in the act of shaking the robe out or folding it or something, it was taken from his grasp, flourished like a magician's cape, and when Doc looked where it had been, Coy was already gone. Doc took 101 back and arrived at the grade up to Thousand Oaks just in time to have to brake abruptly for a paisley-painted VW bus full of giggling dopers, which had materialized in front of him. The passing lane was already solid with semis trying to swerve around the VW, so there was no point trying to go there. Once, Doc might have grown impatient, but with age and wisdom he had come to understand that these units never had any fucking compression to begin with, owing to engineering decisions taken long ago at Wolfsburg. He shifted down, reached for the volume knob on the radio, which was playing "Something Happened to Me Yesterday" by the Stones, and figured he'd get up the hill when he got there. which would have been fine except that now he had time to think about Mickey's necktie and began to wonder how the ape who was wearing it had come by it exactly, and recall unavoidably the hand-painted image of Shasta Fay on her back, spread and wet, and, if he was not mistaken, though he'd only caught a fast glimpse, just about to come, too. Mickey must have been wearing that particular tie when they grabbed him, just took it out of the closet that morning at random, or maybe because of something deeper. Then when they processed him into an inmate uniform at Chryskylodon, they confiscated the tie, and that's when the ape saw it and just decided to take it. Or had Mickey exchanged it later for some mental slam favor, a phone call, a smoke, somebody else's meds? Back in junior college, professors had pointed out to Doc the useful notion that the word is not the thing, the map is not the territory. He supposed you could extend this also to the nudie necktie is not the girl. But he wasn't rational enough right now to feel anything but ripped off, not for Mickey so much as ancient history by now or whatever, for Shasta. Forget the fantasies her picture might have aroused in the ape. How little could she have meant to Mickey for him to let it happen? Doc got back to the beach just at early evening, coming up the back slope of the dunes and over to a hazy view of bay and headlands, a pure sunset of the colors steel takes on as it heats to glowing, lights of airliners, some blinking and some steady, ascending silently from the airport in short, clear curves before setting out to traverse the sky, sometimes finding brief conjunction with an early star, then moving on. He decided to stop in at the office, and as he was letting himself in, the phone started ringing, quietly, as if to itself.
"Where have you been?" said Fritz. "No place I'd recommend. What is it? You sound terrible." "This thing's turning sour, Fritz. I think I found out where they took Mickey. He might not be there any longer or even alive, but either way he could be pretty fucked up by now."
"Better I don't know too much. But how about the police? You sure they can't help?"
Doc found a tobacco cigarette and lit up.
"Never thought I'd hear that from you."
"Just slipped out."
"I wish..." Holy shit, did he feel tired. "Just once I could trust them. But it's like the force of gravity. They never pull in any but the one direction."
"Always admired your principles, Doc, especially now, 'cause I ran those plate numbers you gave me, and it turns out that some of them belong to members of the L.A. Police Reserves. Seems a lot of those guys joined up during the Watts clambake so they could play Run Nigger Run and have it all legal. Since then, they've been like a little private militia the LAPD uses whenever they don't want to look bad in the papers. You got a pencil? You can copy these down. Just don't tell me what happens."
"Oh, you, Fritz. Not at all. Any excuse to feel like I'm surfing the wave of the future here. Just got this new hire in, name of Sparky. Has to call his mom if he's going to be late for supper. Only guess what? We're his trainees. He gets on this ARPANET trip, and I swear it's like acid. A whole nother strange world. Time, space, all that shit."
"So, when they gonna make it illegal, Fritz?"
"What? Why would they do that? Remember how they outlawed acid soon as they found out it was a channel to something they didn't want us to see? Why should information be any different?"
"I better get Sparky to hurry up then. Today he tells me he thinks he knows a way to get into the CII computer up in Sacramento without them knowing. So pretty soon, whatever the State Bureau has, we'll have, too. You can think of us as CII South."
Just then they heard the line current drop. Somebody was tapping in.
"Well, he's a dang good retriever," Fritz went on unperturbed. "If it's there, old Sparky'll find it. He loves that shit."
Remind me to pick him up some of those liver snaps, Doc said. Back at his place, Doc found Dinas with an unlit joint hanging off his lip, sitting by the alley freaking out.
Dinas?
Fucking boards, man.
What happened?
They trashed my place.
Doc almost said, how can you tell? But saw how upset he was. Important thing is, are you okay?
I wasn't there, but if I was, they would have trashed me, too.
The boards, the whole band, Dinas, the rhythm guitar, the bass player, they all broke in, and then what?
They were looking for those pictures I took, man, I know it. My stash was all over the floor. They cleaned out the fridge, put everything in the ostracizer and made smoothies, and didn't even leave any for anybody else.
Anybody else, that's you, Dinas. Why should they leave you any? Dinas thought about this, and Doc watched him start to calm down. Come on in the house, and we'll relight that thing in your mouth there.
Because, Dinas answered Doc's question a bit later, they are supposed to be freaks, a freak surfadelic band. That's their public image. And freaks don't rip off other freaks. And most of all, if they take your food, freaks share it. Didn't you see that movie? There's this actual code of the freaks.
I think, Doc said, that was like 1932, some traveling circus story. Different kinds of freaks.
Whatever. Those boards didn't behave no better than fucking straights do.
You sure this was the boards, Dinas? I mean, were there any, like, witnesses?
Witnesses? Dinas laughed tragically. If there were, they'd be running around all asking for autographs and shit.
Look, I've got the negatives and the proof sheet, and Bigfoot's got that print with Koi in it. So whoever it was, if they didn't find anything at your place, chances are they won't be back.
All my Chinese food.
Dinas shaking his head. Once a month he ordered 30 meals from South Bay Cantonese out on Sepulveda and kept them in the freezer to thaw out one by one for meals over the next month.
Why would they? Even the General Tso's broccoli left over from last night. I was saving that, man.
Next morning, Doc threaded into work among the usual B-12 habitués, noted an interesting bruise on Petunia's leg, and hauled on upstairs to start checking the list of cop auxiliaries he'd got from Fritz, a chore he was not looking forward to. He had run into these would-be heavies now and then, displaying an attitude typical of the overarmed, sporting paramilitary berets and camo fatigues and other Vietnam gear from surplus stores on Hawthorne Boulevard, and decorated with badges and ribbons, some even authentic, though not strictly speaking, earned. He could not recall one of them who'd ever looked at him kindly or even neutrally. These were neighborhood scolds licensed to carry weapons, and heaven help any male civilian with hair that ran much past Marine regulation length. All these people had day jobs, of course. Doc called up, pretending to be different kinds of salesmen, or the DMV in Sacramento with a harmless question, or sometimes just an old buddy who'd drifted out of touch and found the wives, all these guys were family men, in the mood to talk, and talk, a side effect of marriage, as Fritz had imparted to Doc when he was but newly out of the chute.
These broads are all itching to talk because nobody in their home life wants to hear anything they have to say. Sit still for 2 seconds, and they'll be yakking your ear off.
They don't have sisters or other wives to talk to? Doc wondered.
Sure, but generally, that's nothing we can use.
Doc waited till evening after everybody had had supper, settling himself for a quick Taco Bell burrito. A day's worth of nutrition and still a bargain at 69 cents. He had on another short hair wig, a side-parted chestnut number
picked up at a sale on Hollywood Boulevard, and a thrift store suit that looked like a Three Stooges reject. When the traffic had tapered off some, he headed down to an address in the Rossmore, Cypress area, just over the county line. He'd just gotten on the freeway when he heard the radio DJ saying, "Going out from Bambi to all the spotted dickheads in KQAS Kick-Ass Radioland. Here's the lads with their latest single, Long Trip Out." And after a Farfisa intro from Smedley, full of transatlantic Floyd Kramer licks, here came Asymmetric Bob singing, "He's been out there soldiering for a fascist state, so don't expect too much fun on the very first date. He'll be missing the life, he'll be missing the food, he'll be going around in this peculiar mood, wondering how did he get back here in the world with the freaked out hippies and the dope smoking girls. And it's a long trip out from the Yodrang Valley." Smedley singing along in harmony, Somerset with a bottleneck guitar fill. "It's a sad, bad ride when you're far away from the good old boys you left behind in country, where the only thing you want is just another day. Well, it may sound to you like a custom exhaust, but that ain't what he's hearing, and he's flashing back lost in the middle of a night full of fire and fear, and he don't even know who he's hanging with here. And that joint you've been smoking that you thought would help, but just making things worse, you're even fooling yourself, 'cause it's a long trip out from the Mekong Delta. It's the last lost chance when you need a friend. And you're flying on out of Cameron Bay at midnight, and you won't know how to get back home again." Plastic trikes in the yards, people out watering the flowers and working on their cars, kids in the driveway shooting hoops, the high-frequency squeal of a TV sweep circuit through a screen door as Doc came up the path of the address he was looking for, to be followed by the more worldly sound as he reached the front steps of the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour. According to Fritz, the sweep frequency was 15,750 cycles per second, and the instant Doc turned 30, which would be any minute now, he would no longer be able to hear it. So this routine of American house approach had begun to hold for him a particular sadness. Arthur Tweedle was a civilian machinist who worked a regular day shift at the Naval Weapons Station. On weekends, and sometimes weeknights too, he put on a sort of fatigue uniform from D. Jack Frost, the Manson family's favorite surplus store in Santa Monica, and went off to meetings of Vigilant California, along with his neighbor Prescott, another counter-subversive hobbyist also on the list Fritz had run for Doc. Art wore pale horn rims beneath a high, untroubled forehead, and there was little to object to in the face he put on for company, except maybe for a slightly paralyzed look, as if it was a gear he didn't quite know how to shift out of. Doc was posing as a rep for Harry Rope Home Security of Tarzana, which did not, he hoped, exist. Aunt Reet had told him once long ago about the California homeowner's belief that if you run a hairy rope all around your property line, no snakes will ever cross it. "Our system works on a similar principle," Doc now explained to the Tweedles, Art and Cindy. "We set up a network of electric eyes hooked to speakers all along your property line. Anybody breaking the beam will trigger a pattern of subsonic pulses. Some will produce vomiting, some diarrhea. Any of it's enough to send any intruder back where he came from with a hefty dry cleaning bill to deal with. Of course, you and your family can disable the system remotely whenever you need to get on or off your property or mow the lawn or whatever."
"Sounds kind of complicated," said Art. "And besides, We've already got a system right here with a proven track record. And you're looking at him.
But say you had to go out of town.
Cindy?
Squeezing his wife's ass as she came back in with the long-neck beer bottles on a tray.
He's a better shot than me. And we'll be breaking the kids in on 22s before you know it.
Time passes by so quickly, Cindy said.
Sounds like you're covered pretty good. But no harm, I hope, in dropping by like this. You're on a list of local homeowners with a history of concern for property defense. Your service with the police reserves, for example.
We're not technically L.A. residents, but I'm on what they call standby. Car's all dialed and ready to roll. I can get any place they need me in under an hour, said Art.
Every time we talk with the LAPD, there's somebody sure to mention you guys and say how they wish there were more of you. Only so many patrol cars and men in uniform, and it's a dark, ugly situation out there. They need all the help we can give them.
Which didn't turn the tap on full force right away, but little by little, with the Tweedles encouraging each other, as the Beverly Hillbillies rolled along toward Green Acres and the Longnecks kept arriving, Art began to bring out his collection of home defense equipment, which ran from dainty little ladies' pearl-handled 22s through 357 Magnums to Vietnam surplus grenade launchers.
And that's just single shot, said Art. The full auto inventory's back in the shop.
He led Doc through the back door out into the prime-time evening and across the deep lot through sounds from neighbors through window screens, TVs, and after-supper clearing up and kids bickering, to an outbuilding in the shape of a midget barn, holding a variety of assault rifles and light machine guns, and Art's pride and joy, the terminally illegal Gleichschaltung Model 33 automatic bazooka, which required a two-person team, one to aim the 75-millimeter launch tube itself, and the other to drive the modified electric golf cart carrying the magazine, which held up to 100 rounds.
Won't be any darkies sneaking onto this watermelon patch anytime soon, declared Art.
Quite a contraption, Doc said. Where would a guy get hold of something like this?
Oh, dealers, Art demurely. Swap meets, sensitivity group sessions.
How about on the job? Would the department allow you to pack one?
Maybe we'll find out one day soon. Sure would have made a difference in Watts.
Hadn't been much of that type of action lately. How are they keeping you fellas busy?
Weekend maneuvers. Urban counter-guerrilla training. Sometimes I want an individual tended to, but can't commit the manpower. Not very exciting. Stakeouts. Maybe a rock through a window with a warning note. But it's cash on the spot. Enough to keep the pizza man happy, anyhow.
As they were leaving Art's workshop, Doc happened to spot a Nordic-themed ski mask hanging on a door hook. It looked strangely like the ones in the footage Farley Branch had taken of the assault on Chick Planet Massage. Doc's nose started itching furiously.
Hey, I got one like that for Christmas. Just dropping a random nightcrawler off the end of the pier. Well, except mine had these stuffed antlers on top and sort of a big red, you know, like Rudolph-type thing on the nose, battery-operated, so forth.
This one here is standard issue.
Art couldn't help swaggering a little.
Part of the uniform, for when we're out on maneuvers.
Was that you guys a couple weeks back, out at that wing-ding where Mickey Wolfman disappeared?
Sure was. We ended up chasing a gang of bikers all over Channel View Estates. Meanest-looking bunch you ever saw. But push come to shove. No more trouble than Negroes, really.
Yeah, I keep seeing commercials for the place with that detective fella. What's his name?
Bjornson. Sure. Old Bigfoot.
Think I even coordinated with him once or twice, downtown on some trespass cases.
One of America's true badasses, said Art Tweedle.
No kidding. Struck me as more of a college professor than a field cop.
Exactly. That's his cover, like Clark Kent, mild-mannered. But you ought to see him out on the job. Woof! Move over Pete Malloy. Back off Steve McGarrett.
That dangerous, huh? Guess next time we're in touch, I'll have to watch my step.
Which would be almost immediately. After somehow driving under the influence back to the beach by way of surface streets, Doc went in the kitchen and was reaching for the coffee can when the phone kicked into strident alarm.
Idiots Unlimited, first to go, last to know. And how in our pathetically fucked up way can we improve your life tonight?
I'm in an evil mood myself, Bigfoot informed him. So I hope you're not expecting warmth, empathy, nothing like that.
Clark Kent's ass. Having spent the trip home trying to stay in the correct lane and not fall asleep at the wheel, Doc hadn't got around yet to considering what, according to Art Tweedle, was now a far more sinister Bigfoot Bjornsson than he'd imagined. He also understood vaguely that right now might not be the best time to bring any of this up. Maintain, he advised himself. Maintain.
Howdy, Bigfoot.
I apologize if I've interrupted some exceptionally demanding hippie task, like trying to remember where the glue is on the zigzag paper. But it seems we have yet another problem, not unconnected with this fatality of yours for introducing disaster into every life you touch, however glancingly.
Uh-oh.
Doc lit a cool and started looking around for his stash. I am all too aware of the memory lapses you people must constantly struggle with. But would you happen to recall one Rudy Blatnoid, DDS?
One? Sure. Why, are there more?
Keen-witted as ever. Would you rather talk this over in person? We can easily dispatch a chauffeur.
Sorry. You say Dr. Blatnoid?
Has perpetrated his last root canal, I'm afraid. We found him next to a trampoline in Bel Air scarcely an hour ago with a fatal neck injury. Perhaps he even suffered while bouncing in the pitch darkness on that classic resource of backyard fun. Who knows? But certain details do appear inconsistent. He was wearing a suit, necktie, and loafers, seldom considered appropriate for trampoline activities. We began to entertain the possibility of foul play, though so far we have no witnesses, no motives, no suspects. Apart from you, of course.
Not me.
Odd, because only the other night Dr. Blatnoid was observed riding in a vehicle full of dope-crazed hippie freaks, including yourself, which got stopped by officers in Beverly Hills on suspicion of being a pofocac, or potential focus of cult activity.
Okay, the owner of that car, very respectable PV family, by the way, she offered me a ride, and the cops never even gave her a ticket. And Dr. Blatnoid was her friend, not mine.
I don't wish to pry, Sportello, but where have you been tonight? We've been trying to call you all evening.
I was at the movies.
Of course you were. And where was that again?
Hermosa Theater.
And the film was
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly,
which in fact Doc had been to see while the car was in the shop.
This chick I was with wanted to see the other half of the double feature, so we stuck around for that, too. Some English jailbait picture's name I'll think of in a minute.
Ah, the prime of Miss Jean Brody, no doubt. A splendid film, for which Maggie Smith richly deserves her Oscar for Best Actress.
She was which one again? The blonde with the big tits, right?
Not a fan of the British cinema, I take it.
More of a Lee Van Cleef person, to be honest. I mean, that Clint Eastwood, he's okay, but I always end up thinking of him as Rowdy Yates.
Yes. Well, there's an officer here with some evidence bags, and I'll have to get back to the really amusing part of the evening. Would you mind dropping by Parker Center tomorrow? I'd so like to chat about this fool's errand you were kind enough to send me off on. This Coy Harlingen case?
Yeah.
By the way, some friends of Coy's came around yesterday and trashed my associate's apartment. So maybe it ain't such a cold case after all.
There's cold, and there's cold, said Bigfoot enigmatically, and hung up.
That night, Doc dreamed he was a little kid again. He and a